Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Atlantic Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. The articles I'll be reading today were published in the online edition of the Atlantic Magazine, all of them published in November of 2024. Here's a sample of some of the titles. The Greatest Opportunity That Wasn't. Why You Might Need an Adventure. The Georgia Chemical Disaster is a Warning, and a Surprising Window into the Growing Pains of Older Adults. So I hope you enjoy the program today. We'll begin with this article from the Global section, The Greatest Opportunity That Wasn't. Chaos is the Only Likely Winner in the Middle East, by Kim Gattis. Opportunity appears to be the word of the year in the Middle East. War has brought death and devastation to Gaza and Lebanon, but various players still see within it a big chance worth seizing to end the fighting, capitalize on tactical successes, crush their foes, and, more grandiosely, remake the region. If history is any guide to the Middle East, the player with the greatest chance of success is called chaos. Last month, Israel struck the southern suburbs of Beirut and killed Hassan Nasrallah, the Secretary General of the militant group Hezbollah, then followed up with a military campaign against Hezbollah's infrastructure in southern Lebanon and the capital. This had been preceded by the detonation of hundreds of pagers in the hands of Hezbollah operatives. From a tactical perspective, Israel pulled off a stunning feat. The four-decades-old Lebanese group was the most powerful non-state military actor in the world, and Israel decimated its top three tiers of leadership, severely weakening it and throwing it into disarray. White House officials and American journalists suggested that Israel's military success presented an opportunity. Hezbollah has had a chokehold on Lebanese politics for two decades. For the past 2 years, Lebanon's parliament has been unable to elect a president because Hezbollah has vetoed all candidates but its own. Maybe now Hezbollah would pull back. It had pledged not to stop firing on northern Israel until Israel ceased its war in Gaza. While Western pressure could help unlock Lebanese politics and prop up the army at Hezbollah's expense. Regional and local players saw openings too. Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates had shunned Lebanon since 2021 because of Iranian interference in the country's politics and Hezbollah's powerful role. Now those countries sent Lebanon humanitarian aid, perhaps hoping to reclaim some influence over the country's politics and populace. Inside Lebanon, the politicians, who, together with Hezbollah, had driven the country into an economic ravine, now began jockeying for power. Could Amal, the other main Shiite party, seize the advantage? Was this the right moment for opposition parties to ram through a parliamentary vote and elect a president? For two or three days, everything seemed possible, one European diplomat in Beirut told me. But the reality of war set in as Israel's fifth military campaign in Lebanon continued apace. A quarter of Lebanon's population has been displaced. A quarter of its territory is under Israeli evacuation orders. Lebanese institutions, barely functional to begin with, are overwhelmed. Israeli strikes may be targeting Hezbollah, but they have also flattened whole villages in southern Lebanon, as well as buildings in Beirut, killing women and children. Hundreds of civilians have died. Meanwhile, Hezbollah is regrouping, putting up a stiff fight in southern Lebanon, and even sent a drone to target Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's beach residence in Caesarea, Israel. Hezbollah, as we knew it a couple of months ago, has ceased to exist, but the organization remains capable of drawing the Israeli army into a ground war of attrition and sending thousands of Israelis into shelters every day. At least 37 Israeli soldiers have been killed in southern Lebanon so far, including 5 in a single battle. And some reports indicate that Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps has made up for the loss of so many Hezbollah leaders by getting more directly involved in running the group's ground operations. One American official, speaking with me on condition of anonymity, because they were not authorized to speak for the government, wondered why Israel hadn't claimed victory within a week or two of killing Nasrallah. Then, in mid-October, Israeli forces also killed Yahya Sinwar, Hamas's military commander in Gaza. Maybe now they claim victory, the same official asked. The Biden administration did take the opportunity to press Netanyahu for a deal that would end the war in Gaza and allow for the return of Israeli hostages. Secretary of State Antony Blinken flew to Israel last week to deliver that message in person. Now is the time to turn those successes into an enduring strategic success, he said. But that's not what happened. Iran launched a missile barrage at Israel at the beginning of October and last weekend. Israel attacked military sites in Iran. Afterwards, President Joe Biden again called for an end to the escalation. In other words, for Israel to take the win and focus on wrapping up its wars in Gaza and Lebanon. Iranian officials chimed in to say that Tehran had the right to respond, but would prioritize the pursuit of a lasting ceasefire in Gaza and Lebanon instead. The Israeli government seems to see a very different moment of opportunity, a chance to defeat its regional adversaries without actually addressing the Palestinian issue that lies at the root of the conflict. The strikes on Iran were limited, but they took aim at Iran's air defenses, potentially clearing the way for further, deeper strikes. Israeli National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir described the assault as an opening blow. In a statement reported in Haaretz, he said, "We have a historic duty to remove the Iranian threat to destroy Israel." Netanyahu has taken the fight to the Iranians in Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Yemen, and Iran itself. He called the killing of Nasrallah just the first step toward changing the balance of power in the region for years, and said after Sinwar's killing, "I call on you, people of the region, we have a great opportunity to halt the axis of evil and create a different future." Israel has had similar notions before and been mistaken. In 1982, Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin and Minister of Defense Ariel Sharon also saw an opportunity to remake the Middle East. They invaded Lebanon with the intention of evicting the Palestinian Liberation Organization, installing an Israel-friendly president, and forcing Lebanon and perhaps even Syria into a peace agreement. Tactically, this project succeeded. The PLO and its armed militants departed for Tunisia. Strategically, it failed. A Christian president was elected, only to be assassinated, and Syria and Iran launched a bloody campaign of bombings, kidnappings, and hijackings against Israel and the United States. Iran sent its Revolutionary Guards to Lebanon, where they helped establish Hezbollah. Israel occupied South Lebanon for 18 years before withdrawing unilaterally in 2000. That was not even the most recent effort to remake the Middle East by way of Lebanon. In 2006, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert pledged to destroy Hezbollah, and the U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice declared the resulting Israeli onslaught against Lebanon the birth pangs of a new Middle East. Instead, the war ended in a stalemate, with Hezbollah further entrenched in the Lebanese political system, where it grew into the regional paramilitary force it was until mid-September. Of course, few efforts to remake the Middle East by force have been more disastrous than the 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq. Netanyahu was a big proponent of that adventure. He testified as follows before the U.S. Congress in 2002. "If you take out Saddam's regime, I guarantee you that it will have enormous positive reverberations on the region. And I think that people sitting right next door in Iran, young people and many others, will say the time of such regimes, of such despots, is gone." Instead, the U.S. invasion of Iraq removed Iran's key foe from power and emboldened the Islamic Republic to build proxy militias in Iraq, Yemen, and Syria, even while further strengthening Hezbollah in Lebanon. Whoever wins the White House on November 5th should remember this history when Netanyahu tries to sell his latest vision for remaking the Middle East. That's the end of the article. The author, Kim Gattas, is a contributing writer at The Atlantic and a distinguished fellow at Columbia University's Institute of Global Politics. The name of her article was "The Greatest Opportunity That Wasn't." This next article comes to us from the Ideas section, "Why You Might Need an Adventure. In a Rut, Try Shaking Things Up," by Arthur C. Brooks. Almost everyone knows the first line of Herman Melville's 1851 masterpiece, Moby Dick, "Call me Ishmael." Fewer people may remember what comes next, which might just be some of the best advice ever given to chase away a bit of depression. Quote, "Whenever I feel myself growing grim about the mouth, whenever it is a damp, drizzly November in my soul, whenever I find myself involuntarily pausing before coffin warehouses and bringing up the rear of every funeral I meet, then I account it high time to get to sea as soon as I can." End quote. Melville's narrator was ostensibly a 19th-century whaler, whose cure for what he called the hippos was to hit the high seas and forget his troubles. Whaling was not exactly curling up with a cup of hot chocolate and a comfort dog. It was a brutal, exhausting, dangerous job. Just read the rest of the novel for an ample account of that. So Ishmael's prescription might seem counterintuitive advice in today's era of self-care. But Melville perhaps knew something that we have forgotten. When life is getting you down, the answer is not more comfort, but less. If you're troubled by your own case of the hypos, the remedy may be a rough challenge. In 2017, a scholar at the Murdoch University in Australia proposed a provocative hypothesis about why materially comfortable humans would nonetheless be drawn to difficult, even dangerous, tasks. The researcher started from the observation that the universe is at once life-giving and deadly, and that therefore, from the outset, humans needed to embrace risk to flourish. This characteristic, arguably encoded in the genome ever since, may manifest in human beings as a tendency to adopt risky, heroic behaviors and admire them in fellow humans. That genetic inheritance gets reinforced by culture, which is why heroic adventure forms the basis of nearly all mythologies. This was Joseph Campbell's famous conclusion in his 1949 study of archetypes, The Hero with a Thousand Faces. In it, Campbell, who was a professor of literature, laid out the structure of the monomyth, which provides the underlying architecture of a narrative tradition that spans millennia, commonly known as the hero's journey. Such as the Old Testament's King David story and George Lucas's Star Wars series. This myth opens with a call to adventure, proceeds through a series of difficult trials and dangerous obstacles, and finally ends in triumph. The psychoanalyst Carl Jung, who, among other things, popularized the concept of archetypes, saw that for anyone pursuing some metaphorical form of the hero's journey might be indispensable to finding satisfaction in life. Only one who has risked the fight with the dragon and is not overcome by it wins the hoard, he wrote. Evidence from modern researchers does indeed suggest that framing one's life as this type of quest, even when it is difficult or unwelcome, can lead to positive transformation. In one 2023 experiment, scholars asked participants to reframe their life as one that followed the steps in the hero's journey. The researchers found that doing so raised their subjects' sense of purpose. It also made a difficult task more meaningful to them and improved their resiliency to trouble. But beyond simply rewriting your life story to be more of a hero's journey, starting an actual one in the form of a voluntary challenge or adventure can bring immediate and big happiness benefits. Consider a 2013 study finding that experienced climbers tend to derive unusual spiritual inspiration, experience a greater sense of flow, and generally feel happier when they climb mountains. A 2023 meta-analysis of research on outdoor adventures showed that participants in these experiences profited in at least one of four ways: physical and mental balance, personal development, community, and immersion and transformation. A challenging adventure doesn't have to be physical in nature to bestow benefits. It can equally be mental. Indeed, learning new things with a spirit of curiosity and exploration has been shown to induce positive moods. This raises an interesting paradox that appears in this field of happiness research. People derive a lot more happiness from high-skill activities that require learning than they do from low-skill ones that don't. Yet we typically settle for the latter. In other words, you will probably be happier reading about philosophy or science than you will if you just scroll social media. So why are you still scrolling? The obvious answer is that it takes a lot less learning effort and mental focus. And although the happiness benefits of reading Cicero will probably be greater, they are deferred and seem abstract compared with the instant, if largely illusory, gratification of sitting on the couch watching videos on your phone. Just as more demanding and physical adventures raise happiness, their absence can harm well-being. This is a common theme that has emerged from analysis of declining mental health during the coronavirus pandemic lockdowns, when people suffered from a lack of external stimuli and new experiences. Those who did best during this period tended to be people with an adventure-based mindset, who purposely went in search of new, interesting, and challenging things to see and do. If you find yourself a bit grim about the mouth, like Ishmael, you don't necessarily need to risk your life chasing an enraged sperm whale around the world. But you don't have to accommodate your melancholy either. I can suggest two approaches that you can employ right away to take on your hypos. The first strategy is to use that narrative device of the hero's journey to reframe your difficulties. This can be especially powerful if you have recently endured an event or hardship from which you're still struggling to recover. Say, for example, that you went through a bad breakup that you did not initiate. This experience is all too easy to frame as a humiliating defeat or evidence of failure. It is nothing of the sort if you can think of it this way instead, that your breakup jerked you out of a complacent reverie with unwelcome evidence that you were not actually in the right relationship. That realization is in fact your call to adventure, per Campbell. Now, confronted with this truth, you can embark on the second stage of your journey, learning to overcome emotional obstacles and getting stronger through your pain. The greatest stage lies ahead, when you will emerge triumphant, more secure, more emotionally intelligent, more self-knowing, ready to love again and be happier on your own terms. The second strategy, if your life simply feels dull and gray, is to go find a challenge that is worthwhile, hard, maybe even scary. If you have gotten a little too comfortable marking time in work that doesn't inspire you, perhaps you should announce, to yourself at least, your intention to quit and start a job search. If the information you carry in your head has become stale to you, maybe it's time to go back to school in a new field. For a physical challenge, sign up for a half marathon in 6 months' time. Or, my personal favorite, set out to walk a few hundred miles. If your terrestrial existence is getting tedious, go in search of metaphysical truths. And if it shocks people around you, who always took you for someone without a spiritual bone in your body, all the better. There is no guarantee that whatever adventure you choose will turn out the way you hope, of course, and that is the point. If it were safe, it wouldn't be heroic. If it were predictable, it wouldn't be an adventure. Even if your heroic exploits prove to be more uncomfortable or painful than you expected, that, too, is part of the journey. Your object is not to win in a conventional way. It is to wake up and be fully alive. If it's for the first time in a long time, it should be bracing. One last point about the adventure you might seek. A common mistake is not to be Ishmael, but Captain Ahab. Ahab, the doomed skipper of the Pequod, the whaling ship whose crew Ishmael joined, was singularly consumed with finding and killing Moby Dick, the great white whale. The days leading up to Ahab's fateful encounter with the great whale were a fever dream singularly focused on the object of his obsession. This makes Melville's story an inverted myth, an anti-hero's journey that began with a plan born of hate and vengefulness. That brought travails from which Ahab learned nothing, and that ended tragically in a way that permitted no return. Your adventure should have a goal, it is true, but it is called a hero's journey for a reason. Happiness comes not from the blip that is a moment of victory, but from the long arc of living, learning, and loving. That is the best cure for a damp, drizzly November in your soul. The author, Arthur Brooks, is a contributing writer at The Atlantic and the host of the How to Build a Happy Life podcast. His column was titled, Why You Might Need an Adventure. I'm going to interrupt for just a minute to remind those of you that may have tuned in late, this is The Atlantic Magazine Program, brought to you by Sunsounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sunsounds volunteer reader. I'm reading articles from the online edition of The Atlantic. They were all published in November of 2024. I will continue on with this article from the science section. The Georgia chemical disaster is a warning. Climate change could mean more spills and fires. America isn't ready. By Hannah Kuros. Since September 29th, when the smell of chlorine first began to waft over Metro Atlanta, Georgia residents' lives have been upended by an enormous chemical fire. That day, a chemical plant containing millions of pounds of pool sanitizer burned to the ground in Conyers, Georgia. The blaze was extinguished in hours, but an enormous plume of orange and black smoke remained for days, so thick that drivers on Interstate 20 struggled to see past their windshield. Authorities ordered 17,000 people to evacuate and more than 90,000 to shelter in place for the first 48 hours. For those nearest the plant, the order lasted 19 days. The county's public schools reopened on October 21st after weeks of virtual learning. Local doctors say they're seeing children with sore throats, burning eyes, and unyielding headaches. Elaine Fontaine Kabagarhari, a real estate agent in Conyers, told me that her 6-year-old daughter had 4 asthma attacks in 3 days after not needing her inhaler for half a year. The smoke has mostly cleared, but residents say they still smell and taste chlorine in the air. Officials in Rockdale County, where the fire broke out, have filed a federal lawsuit against BioLab, the company that owns the chemical plant, for negligence. We are aware of the filing, and we are reviewing it thoroughly, and will respond accordingly, a BioLab spokesperson told me in a statement. We are not in a position to comment further at this time, other than to say that our goal has been, and continues to be, to work constructively with the county. Georgia's initial response to the fire was limited by Hurricane Helene, which smacked into Florida's Gulf Coast before it killed more than 200 people, including 33 in Georgia. Downed trees and power lines in Rockdale County, and kept state emergency crews busy with rescues. Helene may not have triggered the explosion. Officials who are still investigating the cause of the fire have suggested that a malfunctioning sprinkler is to blame, but it certainly complicated the response. Such a collision of natural and chemical disasters may become only more common as the world warms, leaving people who live near facilities like the one in Conyers vulnerable to uncertain health effects and worse. Conyers, roughly a 45-minute drive from Atlanta, is not even close to the Gulf of Mexico, where Helene formed. The worst of the storm's damage came even farther inland, near Asheville, North Carolina, demonstrating the long reach of such disasters. Things could have been much worse in their areas closer to where the hurricane peaked. The Gulf Coast is the backbone of U.S. chemical manufacturing. Texas and Louisiana are home to facilities that supply 80% of American petrochemicals. Alabama stuffs more than 25 manufacturers into its 60-mile chemical corridor, where factories make products such as synthetic rubber. Chemical plants along Florida's west coast supply the state's boat and spa factories. Manufacturing, storing, and mixing chemicals require precise environmental control. Chemical processes depend on things being in range, Mike Mastrangelo, a healthcare emergency planner in the Galveston, Texas area, told me. That can mean maintaining the right pressure, temperature, or humidity to keep a chemical stable. For example, TCCA, a white powdery substance used as a pool sanitizer and currently believed to be at the root of the biolab fire, is stable when fully dry or fully submerged in water. But if it gets wet and can't fully dissolve, it explodes into a cloud of toxic chlorine gas. Extreme weather threatens the ability of chemical plants to maintain these delicate conditions. Floodwaters can turn over storage tanks, burst pipes, and make drainage systems spew waste, so loose chemicals mix and catch fire. Hurricane-force winds can disable power grids and, consequently, HVAC systems. In 2017, flooding from Hurricane Harvey knocked out the power supply for a plant outside Houston that produced temperature-sensitive peroxides. The chemicals overheated and self-ignited, releasing toxic peroxide fumes and forcing 200 people to evacuate. In 2020, Hurricane Laura ripped the roof off buildings in a Louisiana plant, also owned by BioLab. Rain dripped onto the TCCA, causing a chlorine explosion. A federal investigation concluded that BioLab had been unprepared for the winds produced and had a largely non-functional fire protection system. The BioLab spokesperson told me that the 2020 incident stemmed from Hurricane Laura's unprecedented impact, but he did not address questions about the safety issues raised by the investigation. He also directed me toward a recent press release announcing the successful completion of emergency response operations at the Conyers facility. Chemical plants across the United States are concentrated near ports, which makes shipping cheaper, but raises the risk of many disasters that climate change makes worse, such as hurricane storm surge. A 2022 investigation of more than 10,000 facilities that use high-risk chemicals, conducted by the Government Accountability Office, found that 1 in 3 was located in an area where flooding, storms, or wildfires are especially likely. Flooding was by far the biggest concern. At least 133 chemical plants are already at risk of flooding at high tide, and hundreds more are in areas that may be inundated by storm surge in a Category 4 or 5 hurricane, according to the report. Furthermore, experts predict that sea levels along the Gulf will be 14 to 18 inches higher by 2050, adding to the problem. The EPA holds some of these at-risk facilities, those that contain any of the 258 chemicals that are inherently toxic or flammable, to a higher safety standard. The companies must work with local responders to make detailed emergency plans. Consider how climate change affects the vulnerability of their facilities and, upon request, inform residents in a 6-mile radius what hazardous chemicals they live near. But the EPA does not have special disaster preparedness requirements for reactive chemicals, compounds that are safe until they suddenly aren't, including TCCA, which has caused multiple chemical disasters. The U.S. Chemical Safety and Hazard Investigation Board, a federal watchdog that advises rulemaking, has documented more than 170 serious accidents caused by reactives, resulting in more than 100 deaths that took place from 1980 to 2020. Chemical companies have little incentive to shore up their defenses against natural disasters at facilities with reactive substances, James Elliott, a co-director of Rice University's Center for Coastal Futures and Adaptive Resilience, told me. That leaves those sites especially vulnerable to extreme weather and dangers to the communities that surround them. The EPA told me in a statement that it plans to evaluate potential additions to its list of regulated substances, but that any changes will be a multi-year process. Some vulnerable towns are already preparing for a future in which chemical disasters are more common. In Galveston, Texas, a coastal city full of refineries, a mascot named Wally the Turtle regularly teaches schoolchildren about the risk of chemical disasters, Mastrangelo told me. He runs chemical disaster drills at hospitals in the area. But, he said, his county is an outlier. Many more communities are worryingly unprepared, even in areas that are clearly at high risk of a natural disaster triggering a chemical one. About 40% of Americans live within 3 miles of a facility that's subject to the EPA's higher safety standard. Many more likely live near a plant with reactive chemicals. This interactive, county-by-county map tracks facilities with chemicals that pose a risk to human health. Not all of those facilities are along the Gulf Coast or in places that have historically been subject to hurricanes, wildfires, severe heat waves, and the like. But this past summer showed that nowhere in the U.S. is safe from extreme weather, and that any community near a chemical facility is at risk of suffering two disasters at once. That ends the article. The author, Hannah Quiros, is an assistant editor at The Atlantic. The title of her article was "The Georgia Chemical Disaster is a Warning." This article is from the Culture section. The title, "A Surprising Window into the Growing Pains of Older Adults." The men of the Golden Bachelorette are looking for love, but they're also finding friendship with one another. By Hannah Georgis. For more than 25 years, some of reality TV's most memorable and villainous contenders have declared that they're not here to make friends. But on The Golden Bachelorette, the second Bachelor franchise installment focused on a romantic lead older than 60, friendship isn't a fruitless distraction from the main event. The new series follows the 61-year-old widow Joan Vassos and an eclectic group of men hoping to win her over, some of whom have also lost their spouse. In a pleasant break from standard reality TV convention, including within the Bachelor franchise, many of the show's most charming moments focus on the friendships formed among Joan's suitors. By highlighting the men's bonds with one another, the new series builds on the Golden Bachelor's refreshing exploration of finding love after grief and the ways a person's identity can shift in late adulthood. Together, the men wrestle with profound changes brought on by widowhood, retirement, divorce, and other big transitions. In its inaugural season, The Golden Bachelorette has offered a rare window into some of the distinct social and emotional challenges that Americans encounter later in life, and the varied connections that help them mitigate such weighty stressors. Last year, Joan was an early favorite on The Golden Bachelor, where she quickly captured the septuagenarian widower Gary Turner's interest. But after just 3 episodes, the mother of 4 walked away from the show to care for her newly postpartum daughter. Yet being on the program offered an emotional reward beyond finding a permanent partner. During her grief time as a contestant, my heart kind of got a little fix from Gary, she said during a tearful exit. As you get older, you become more invisible. People don't see you anymore. Her words resonated with many Golden Bachelor viewers, especially franchise newcomers and other women around her age. Now, with Joan at the fore, the Golden Bachelorette sheds light on the inner complexities of the men who are hoping she'll see them. And by turning its attention to the unlikely intimacy forged among the male contestants, the show pushes beyond the one-dimensional stoicism that's common in depictions of men their age. Most of the 24 men competing for Joan's affections, who are between 57 and 69, have experienced bereavement or devastating heartbreak. Although the world of the Golden Bachelorette, where the suitors live with one another under the same roof, is obviously a staged environment, the losses the contestants have suffered are very real. As of 2023, more than 16% of Americans who are 60 or older, about 13 million people, were widowed. Losing a spouse has tremendous consequences for the surviving partner's physical, mental, and emotional health, which can begin even prior to bereavement, especially for caregiving spouses. And yet, we as a society are not necessarily super skilled or comfortable at talking about death and loss. Jane Lowers, an assistant professor at Emory University School of Medicine, told me, "Some people will back away from engaging with somebody who's going through grief. A partner's death can also lead to a crisis of self," she added. "If the bereaved spouse had come to see caregiving, or being half of a marital unit, as their essential identity." On The Golden Bachelorette, loss largely brings people together, even as it prompts difficult internal reckonings. Many of Joan's most meaningful conversations with her suitors make reference to her late husband, the milestones they shared, and her conflicting feelings as she attempts to find love again. But even when she isn't around, the men speak candidly about grief, Joan's as well as their own. When one suitor announces that he's leaving the mansion because his mother died, the others rally around him, with some tearing up as they offer their condolences and reflect on how beautiful his interactions with Joan have been. Another moving exchange involves a widower named Charles, who has spent almost 6 years racked with guilt, wondering if he could have done something to save his wife from a fatal brain aneurysm. Speaking with Guy, an emergency room doctor, Charles shares that one detail of his wife's death has always troubled him, and he looks visibly relieved when Guy reassures him, after explaining the science, that there was nothing he could have done. Later, as Charles recalls this conversation when talking with Joan, he tells her that it changed my life. These scenes aren't just a striking contrast to the hostile atmosphere that's typical of many dating-oriented competition series in which the contestants spent time together. They're also an instructive representation of relationship building among older men. Rather than peaceably keeping to themselves, the Golden Bachelorette men prioritize vulnerability and openness with one another. "I came in, arrived at the mansion with sadness, missed my wife," Charles says when he leaves midway through the season. "After several weeks here at the mansion, it really helped me. the remaining friends, we bond together. We opened our hearts. The silent anguish that Charles describes has dangerous, real-world ramifications. After the death of a spouse, widowers experience higher rates of mortality, persistent depression, and social isolation than widows do. It's in part because they don't have these close friendships, like we're seeing on the show. Deborah Carr, a sociology professor at Boston University and the author of Golden Years, Social Inequality in Later Life, told me. Their social ties often were through work, and then that diminishes once they retire, or their former wives did the role. But widowers aren't the only demographic represented on The Golden Bachelorette, and today's older Americans have far more complex social lives than in past years, partly because marriage, companionship, and caregiving all look different and often less predictable than they did several decades ago. Now, about 36% of adults who get divorced are older than 50, a rising phenomenon known as gray divorce. As Carr put it, we're certainly moving away from that one marriage for life, which shifts how single adults past 50 see their romantic prospects. The Golden Bachelorette chronicles what it takes for contestants to open themselves up to love, romantic or otherwise. As these changes happen in real time, the show keeps an eye toward the importance of emotional transparency when navigating later in life relationships. The men on the show sometimes acknowledge that they were raised to feel uncomfortable with overt displays of sentimentality, but they appear to recognize the long-term toll of suppressing their feelings. Carr added that she was pleased to see how quickly a group of men with so little in common came to embrace one another. Even though it's an artificial situation, she noted, a lot of those lessons can be imported to other men. On The Golden Bachelor, the isolated production environment ended up nudging the women toward one another, too. We were all sequestered in this mansion without our phones and television and social media, so it made it very easy to connect with people very quickly at a deep level, Kathy Swartz, one of the contestants, told me. When we spoke, Kathy was just leaving Pennsylvania, where she'd been visiting Susan Knowles, one of her closest friends from The Golden Bachelor. Both told me in separate conversations that they counted joining the show as a transformative choice, and that their age also gave them a unique perspective on discovering love, whether with Gary or with new friends. For Susan, watching the men navigate the same journey has been fascinating, and it's different from watching the franchise's earlier seasons or other reality shows, because the contestants are mostly parents and grandparents. We've given our lives to our children, Susan explained, adding the younger contestants have not experienced what we have. We've had the ups, the downs, the horrible, the broken hearts, the happy moments. By the time they enter the mansion, the golden contestants largely know who they are and what they want. That changes what it means to win. Though they may not come to the show looking for new platonic bonds, we see the participants recognize the beauty of forging friendships with peers who meet them as individuals, not as extensions of their families or employers. This season's men may have begun as strangers, but they leave the Golden Bachelorette having found a group of brothers, as one departing participant calls his competitors. That's the end of the article. The title was A Surprising Window into the Growing Pains of Older Adults by Atlantic staff writer Hanta Georgis. I have a limited amount of time left in the broadcast, so I'm going to end up with Dear James column. It's sort of the Atlantic magazine's answer to Dear Abby. So I hope you enjoy it. I love to drive fast and I cannot stop. Is my bad habit going to be my demise? It's by James Parker. Here's the editor's note. Every Tuesday, James Parker tackles a reader's existential worry. He wants to hear about what's ailing, torturing, or nagging you. Submit your lifelong or in-the-moment problems to Dear James at theatlantic.com. Dear James, do you ever feel like you know how you're going to die? I'm 38 years old, have no health conditions, take no medication, and work a low-risk job with manageable stress. The way I see it, I'm Teflon, except for two Achilles heels. Both heels. Number one, my driving. Number two, my diet. I'm not an insane driver. It's not as if I weave between six lanes of traffic to gain one car length. But I do love to drive fast, and I also hate to waste time. It's a potent combination. I've had enough close calls that I can't deny the significantly non-zero chance that one day all the high-speed moving variables align to end me. If the car doesn't get me, it'll be my high-fat, high-calorie diet. Despite my life of fast food abundance, I am not obese because I am extremely tall and get regular exercise. My large frame hides a lot of excesses. Though external warning signs are absent, everything I know about nutrition makes me feel like I'm headed for a stealth cardiac event or terrible late-detected cancer. Don't get me wrong, I love living, but I think that's why I find myself handicapping the cause of my own death. Is this normal, or at least not unprecedented? Dear reader, first, slow down, dude. I'm not being metaphorical. Go slower in your car. In my mind, I see you zooming around out there, folded over the wheel in your tallness, blazing with your fast food calories, calculating your odds, making a bit of a menace of yourself. I like being speedy too, but think about who else is on the road with you. The panicking, the wild with anger, the hesitant, the half asleep, the ones who need their eyes tested. Also, the nice people, just driving along on their way to Chuck E. Cheese. Do not conscript them into your game of high-speed moving variables. Now, to your question, is it normal to envision or predict the cause of one's own death? I think it most certainly is. The other night I attended a performance by the Irish comedian Tommy Tiernan, a very Beckettian figure in his baggy black suit and tipped-back hat, speaking lyrically about madness and death, twitching around in the spotlight. Tiernan told us that he was all for the death penalty because it gives the condemned man a how and a when and a why. You're going to die at 3 p.m. on Thursday by such and such a method because you kill someone with an axe, rather than conking out randomly in a room at the Doubletree, was his point. Me, I imagine rather fondly that I'll get hit by a bus. I picture myself looping through the air post-impact in slow motion, full of regrets and reconsiderations, perhaps even having a last-minute breakthrough. But the Lord comes like a thief in the night, doesn't he? So I'm pretty sure that when the ultimate moment arrives, that's now not how it'll be. You too might get a surprise. In the meantime, I'm glad you love living. Eat fewer McNuggets and take your foot off the gas. Dear James, because I'm an old geezer, I'll be 80 next June, I often reflect on the wreckage I may have left behind in my long life. In the past couple of years, someone I hurt emotionally has stopped talking to me entirely, and he's made it clear that I shouldn't try to get in touch with him either. Over the course of about 30 years, I have sincerely apologized to him a couple of times for the damage I did, But now, in my old age, it occurs to me that an apology, no matter how sincere, does not have the emotional and moral weight that asking for forgiveness does. It's not really getting to the bottom of what happened between us. What do you think? Dear reader, I don't know how anybody expects to get to the end of their life, especially a long life, without a look over their shoulder at the mile-wide seam of smoldering. Mad Max ruination they've left behind them. Craters, twisted frames, flattened people. Equally, I'm sure your 8 decades have been strewn with uncounted good deeds and good vibes. Why not reckon them up? I once got dumped by a friend, extremely painful, and I sought advice from someone with more experience than me. Ah, he said, when it's over, it's so over. And so it has proved. Sounds to me like your friend can't, won't, or is disinclined to forgive you. So forgive yourself. Let yourself off the hook. Leave him to his life and get back to living yours. And when the ruminations arise, those creeping wreckage thoughts, simply give them a nod, and then turn your mind elsewhere. Make yourself a nice cup of coffee, and sit and watch the weeds grow. In rustic peace, James. And that completes the column, and it also completes the broadcast today. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you found it informative. This has been the Atlantic Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your volunteer reader. I've been reading from the online edition of The Atlantic. The articles I've read today were published in November of 2024. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week. Keep listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. And if you've missed a program that you'd like to hear, go to the sunsounds.org website, click on the broadcast info and audio, then click on Demand, and you'll see a list of articles available to you. Hopefully, you'll find the one you're looking for. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.